911. Where is your emergency?
Yeah, I need an ambulance, man.
Okay, to what address?
132 Perry Street.
On June 19th, 2015, 46-year-old Jason Carter walked into his parents' Iowa home and found his mother dead on the floor. "I need an ambulance bad," he tells the dispatcher, and then gives the address.
"It's Bill Carter, and I'm his son, and my mom. Mom's laying here on the floor. I don't know what happened."
He said there's blood everywhere, that she's dead, and that he doesn't know what happened. Shirley Carter, a 68-year-old mother and grandmother, was on the kitchen floor in a pool of blood, with her arms folded across her chest. We'll later find out that she died from 2 gunshot wounds. A 3rd shot had also been fired, but missed.
"Okay, is she inside the house or outside?"
"She's laying here on the kitchen floor."
"Okay, and this is..."
He repeats that there's blood all over and that he doesn't know what happened. Signs inside the house pointed to a possible burglary. Drawers in the home office were tossed open, and a gun inside a safe in the basement was missing. The Marion County Sheriff's Department conducted the investigation into her death. The department was so small at the time that they didn't have a detective on their own force. The sheriff asked the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, also known as DCI, to assist with conducting interviews and testing forensic evidence. A missing gun, the one believed to be the murder weapon, was never found. Rather than telling the community to be on the lookout for a murderer, as the Carter family expected, authorities looked inward at the family. And for nearly a year and a half after her death, no one was charged with Shirley's murder.
"There's a hole through the floor, dude, in the refrigerator. I don't know what she was trying to... I don't get what happened."
"You said there's a hole through the floor in the refrigerator?"
"Yeah."
"Okay.
And she's lying in a pool of blood. She's still alive. I'll get it. She's not dead."
Okay.
Who were the suspects? Did deputies fully investigate leads? Was it a burglary gone bad? Or was the real killer someone Shirley trusted? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 83. I want to take you on a trip to rural Iowa. Lacona is a town of about 360 people in Marion County, about 35 miles southeast of Des Moines. Bill and Shirley Carter met while they were in high school. They went to their homecoming dance together, and then they got married, when Shirley was just 16 and when Bill was 17. Bill graduated high school, while Shirley became pregnant with their first daughter, Jana, and didn't complete school. Bill and Shirley went on to live at their home on Perry Street in Lacona, Iowa, for 50 years, and raised their 3 children there. Jana was the oldest, then Billy Dean, and the youngest was Jason.
"What do you do for a living?"
I am a farmer. Always have been a farmer. I started farming when I was 17 years old."
That's Bill, testifying in court about how he farmed row crops like corn and beans. In 2015, they were farming just under 1,000 acres of row crops and hay.
"Bill, in June of 2015, were you still a full-time farmer?"
Yes, I was."
"Were you starting to make the decision of whether or not to slow down a little?"
"Yes, I had been for a few years."
"Did Shirley want to slow down?"
No.
In your mind, was Shirley a farm wife or a farmer?
She was a farmer and proud of it.
While their two oldest children didn't follow in their footsteps, Jason became a farmer too. Bill and Shirley helped Jason start his own business by loaning him money to buy farming equipment and rent land to grow on. In December 2014, Bill bought a new sprayer for his crops. He made an agreement where Jason could use the sprayer for his own crops if he sprayed Bill's as well. Jason didn't own his own land, and since it's harder to make a profit if renting the land as opposed to owning, Bill offered to sell Jason 80 acres of his land, but Jason told him he didn't want it.
Bill, what were you thinking when Jason said he didn't want that land?
I thought that that showed selfishness.
Why?
Because I farmed the land. The deer ate my corn around the edges. That's a problem we have in southern Iowa. And I just thought it showed that he was being selfish in not even considering buying that because of the deer problem.
Jason was farming about 900 acres in 2015. The landlord Jason was renting land from had died the year before, and so the landlord's son decided to sell the land. The markets dropped, and Bill was concerned that Jason could be short more than $100,000 to pay off his debt. According to Bill, at the time of Shirley's death in 2015, their land was worth $3.5 to $4 million.
Did you and her ever disagree about you stepping aside and turning over land to Jason?
Yes.
Was Jason Carter in 2015 aware what was in your will?
Yes.
How was he aware of what was in your will?
When Shirley and I changed the will, we showed Jason and Shelley what we had done. We showed them the will.
And when you say Shelley, who is Shelley?
Shelley is Jason's wife.
Did Jason play any role in the administration of your will?
He was appointed the executor.
According to Bill, if both he and Shirley had died in June of 2015, Jason would have inherited the farm and another $800,000 in cash assets. He also stood to inherit their equipment, which was worth even more. On the evening of June 18th, 2015, Jason, his wife Shelley, and their kids were at Bill and Shirley's house. Bill told Jason he planned on taking a load of corn to the plant in a nearby town and then was going to put up hay the next day. That next morning, on June 19th, Bill and Shirley went into town and had a cup of coffee. Bill then dropped Shirley back at home and told her he would see her between 11 and 11:30. Then he made the hour drive into Eddyville, where he hauled corn to the Eddyville Cargill plant. By 9 a.m., Bill had unloaded his corn faster than he expected. He decided to stop at KC's to get a coffee and a donut. But he headed home when he got a call from his daughter, Jana.
She said, Dad, Mom's dead. And Jason found her and he won't call 911. You've got to call 911. And I did. And then I took off for home. As fast as I could get there.
When he arrived home, he said Jason was on the deck, talking on the phone. He didn't stop to talk to him. He just ran inside the house.
What did you see?
I found Shirley on the floor. And she was just looked like she was sleeping. Her eyes were closed. Her hands were crossed. And her legs were crossed.
What did you do?
Jason came in. And I said, Jason, look how she's laying. You don't die that way. And then he said, Dad, go downstairs. See if a gun went off.
And did you?
I had a picture of her. The first thing I did was check her carotid artery. And she was dead. And then I picked her head up and I kissed her on the forehead. And she was cold.
Bill said there was a small pool of blood along her left side that was liquid and wasn't drying. Jason then started pointing out bullet holes. There was one in the refrigerator and one in the floor. Jason then told him that he had been robbed.
He was standing in the doorway between the kitchen and the office. And he said, some son of a bitch has robbed you and they've killed Mom.
Bill saw that his office was a mess, with things bumped over and contents of drawers spilt on the floor. The two other Carter children, Billy and Jana, then came to the house.
Do you recall your son, Jason, saying anything that seemed odd to you?
He said to Billy, you know, he'd had to rack another round in.
Did that make a whole lot of sense to you at the time?
No, it didn't.
Bill, how would you explain your emotional state on June 19, 2015?
It was a mess. It was terrible. They say your life can change in an instant. It did. It changed. And it'll never be the same.
Bill noted that 3 years ago, when the sheriff's office busted a nearby meth lab and the men running it took off, deputies warned the community to lock their doors. But after his wife was murdered, Bill said the sheriff's office told people not to worry, which made him angry. He said he told authorities he had a good family and that it couldn't have happened within it. But as the sheriff's office continued their investigation, they interviewed members of the Carter family. They interviewed Jason on the day of the murder. The following audio clip is from that interview, when Jason describes finding his mother's body. It's difficult to make out exactly what he's saying, so I'll recap it afterwards.
I pulled in the drive and parked and was going to get the tractor and start up and start the PTO going. Start mixing the chemicals that are left in there from yesterday's spraying. And I decided, well, I got plenty of time before they get out here. I'm going to run inside and see what Mom's doing and see if she's going to start dinner and get something to drink. I walked in the door. I see her legs and feet together laying there. But I couldn't see the top half of her body behind the table. And I said, Mom? And I thought she was laying there, because when she gets dizzy, she's had dizzy spells for the last couple of years. She'll lay down on her back to get over it. I just thought that's what she was doing. And I took another step forward, and I could see the shadowing shit. It was fucking blood around her arm. I thought maybe she fell off the counter because she gets stuff up high and hit her head. And I knelt right down and I grabbed hold of her leg. She was stiff.
He said he pulled into his parents' lot and parked. He was going to get the tractor started. He then went inside to see what his mom was doing, to see if she was starting dinner, and also to get something to drink. He walked in and she was laying there. He couldn't see the top half of her body under the table. He thought she was just having a dizzy spell, but he took another step forward and saw blood around her arm. He then thought maybe she fell off the counter and hit her head. He grabbed her leg and she was stiff. Investigators continued to interview Jason over the next few weeks and months after her death. They started to notice what they say were inconsistencies in his statements. And they weren't the only ones who were suspicious of Jason. His own family started to suspect him too, and they decided to take action themselves. Upset that authorities hadn't charged anyone for Shirley's death, Bill did what he said was his family's only way to seek justice. He and his other son, Billy, sued Jason for the wrongful death of his mother. The case went to civil court in 2017. Civil proceedings require findings based only on a preponderance of the evidence, which is a lower standard than reasonable doubt facing prosecutors in criminal cases. At his civil trial, there was testimony that Jason's fingerprint was found on the gun case, which was the only piece of forensic evidence produced. Jason took the stand in his own defense, and the defense presented a timeline of Jason's movements that morning that they said would prove that it was impossible for Jason to have committed the murder. According to phone records, Shirley last made a phone call that ended at 8:46 a.m. Video surveillance captured Jason leaving the Cargill plant in Eddyville, which was a little over 50 minutes away from his parents' house, at 9:57 a.m., after he too had dumped a load of grain that morning. Jason said he then drove his grain truck back to a farm in Pleasantville and then drove his pickup truck to his parents' house, where he arrived shortly after 11 a.m. It was then when he found his mother's body. But prosecutors maintained that no one saw what routes he took or what speed he was driving, and that he would still have plenty of time to commit the murder. On December 15, 2017, the jury agreed. They found Jason Carter civilly responsible for shooting Shirley Carter to death. He was ordered to pay $10 million to Shirley's estate. 2 days after the civil trial ended, Jason was arrested for first-degree murder. Authorities said information revealed in the civil trial led them to finally charge him. While Jason awaited trial in his criminal case, he appealed the civil judgment. In a hearing to overturn the ruling, the defense produced a photo from 2003 showing Jason assembling that gun case. They said that's how his fingerprints made it onto the case. But in March 2018, the judge denied the defense motion for summary judgment. 2 months later, the defense filed a brief in support of petition for relief regarding the civil verdict, and in it, they provided the names of other suspects. One of those suspects was Robert Joe Sedlock, an inmate who investigators interviewed on September 3rd, 2015, about 3 months after the murder. Sedlock said he knew who the real killers were and that Jason was not one of them. He gave the names of Joel Followill, his brother John Followill, and Matt Kamerick, and said they were in the process of burglarizing a home when the female homeowner spooked them and John Followill shot her twice. But in January 2019, the judge denied the defense's motion for a new civil trial. He ruled that the inmate's testimony represented hearsay. And so the criminal case against Jason Carter went to trial in March of 2019. Due to all the publicity surrounding the case, the trial was moved about 150 miles west from Marion County to Council Bluffs in Pottawatomie County. Prosecutor Ed Bull gave opening statements on behalf of the state.
This case isn't about money. It's about pressure. It's about the reality of what's going to happen next. It's about, am I going to be able to be a full-time farmer? It's about whether or not my credit line's going to be renewed. This case is about pressure. It's not about dollars and cents. But by contrast, Bill and Shirley perfectly understood the realities of the farming world. Over their lifetime, they started with nothing, and they ended up with about $6 million in land. In addition to that, Jason Carter knew exactly what was in his parents' will. He was the executor. And because he was the only farmer, he got all the dirt when his parents died. In addition to that, he got a third of the liquid assets, which included $800,000 in a savings account. Was Jason Carter planning on killing both his parents that day? I don't know. Did his dad just not show up in time? I don't know. But I'm not required to prove to you why Jason Carter did what he did. I'm only required to prove to you that he did shoot and kill his mom.
Bull talked to the jury about corn and how it is probed and dumped. Then he told them the prosecution's theory. He said that while Bill was dropping Shirley back off at their home on June 19th, Jason was dropping his son off at school. He said Jason then drove to where he kept his semi, fired it up, and went to his parents' house. While he was waiting for the farm equipment to warm up, he went inside to see his mother. Jason called his sister Jana at 11:08 a.m. Jana was frantic and asked him if he had called 911. Bull said Jason didn't want to. But 3 minutes later, he was on the phone with 911 dispatchers, telling them that there was blood everywhere. But Bull pointed out that the blood was only under Shirley's body. Bull then spoke about the oddity of a son not wanting to call 911 after finding his mother's body. He said Jason later claimed he went right inside the house after arriving there, but that would leave a 13-minute gap in his timeline. Bill arrived afterwards, and Jason then said to him, "Dad, looks like someone tried to rob you," referring to the office area. Bull said that disarray would be an important clue because it was staged. He said it was an amateur's attempt to make the scene look like Shirley had interrupted a burglary. Bull told the jury that the evidence will establish that Jason somehow knew his mom was shot with a rifle owned by his father, and that the shooter then took that rifle. But Bull did admit that it was not a perfect investigation.
One of the reasons why I'm not required to prove to you motive is there's absolutely nothing I can tell you that would make sense of why it is a son shoots and kills his mother. There's no good reason I can give you. And that's why the law doesn't require me to. The law requires me to prove each and every element of murder in the first degree. But you're going to find at the conclusion of this case that Judge McCall isn't going to tell you I had to prove why he did it. And it makes perfect sense why I don't have to do that, because there is no good reason. What I can tell you is that what we will prove to you is that there are clues that lead to only one conclusion. And based on the evidence, at the conclusion of the evidence, we will ask that you return a verdict finding Jason Carter guilty of murder in the first degree. As the facts will support it, the law will compel it, and justice for Shirley will demand it.
Next up was the defense to give their opening statements.
Over and over, I'm going to ask, does this make sense? But certainly we're going to talk about this investigation. And there are a lot of reports. Reports about where the murder weapon might have been. Individuals who may have confessed. A possible recording of a confession of a burglar who says that he was involved in the death of Shirley Carter. And look at what law enforcement did and did not do in response to those. We're going to talk about another statement, too, and that's the statement of Bill Carter Sr., who arrives on the scene, grabs his wife, holds her, and thereafter says, "She was stiff as a board. She was in rigor mortis. And I know what rigor mortis is." And Bill Carter says, "I know what rigor mortis is. I was a butcher. She was stiff as a board. She was cold. And I believe everyone who testifies will agree that if that's true, it would be impossible for Jason Carter to have been the killer, because it simply puts it out of the time frame when he would have been there.
That's lead defense attorney Christine Branstad. Jason loved his mother, she said, spent time with her, and now he's unable to take time to grieve because some of his statements were taken out of context. According to the defense, Jason was at a facility in Eddyville, Iowa at 9:52 a.m. He called his sister at 11:08 a.m. to tell her that he found their mother dead and reached out to 911 just 3 minutes after that. They argued that it would have been impossible for him to commit the murder, considering the distance between his workplace in Eddyville and his parents' home, the cell phone information, and the timeline. Branstad posed this question to the jury: do all clues point to Jason, or were there too many ignored? The state called Bill Carter to the stand to testify against his son.
My name is Bill G. Carter. That's C-A-R-T-E-R.
Bill, how old are you?
I just turned 73.
Who was your wife?
My wife was Shirley Dean Carter.
And Bill, can you tell me how old was Shirley when she died?
Shirley was 68.
Bill told the jury about his wife, their children, and about the events of the morning of June 19th, 2015. He said after he found Shirley dead, he checked the house for his unloaded revolver. It was still in their bedroom closets.
I went back to Shirley, and I held her, and then Kurt Seddon came in. He was a fireman, and he said, "You got to come out with me, Bill."
Did you leave?
Yeah.
Now, you told this jury Shirley felt cold.
Yes.
Did she feel cold to you?
When I kissed her on the forehead, she felt cold.
Bill, did your wife feel different that day than any other day in the 52 years you were married to her?
Yes. Yes.
As it relates to your marriage, those 52 years, had you ever spent a night apart?
Yes, once when I went skiing in Colorado. Once.
One time in 52 years?
Yes.
In a recorded interview between Bill and DCI just days after Shirley's death, Bill said Shirley was terribly cold when he found her dead. She had rigor mortis. I was a butcher at one time and did a lot of skinning and butchering, and I know when something's been dead for a long time, and she was so cold and stiff, he said in 2015. But during the civil trial, Bill had said that his wife was not in rigor mortis. On the stand in the criminal trial, Bill said Shirley was on the floor next to the air conditioner, which was blowing on her legs and feet. Bill said he went outside and waited while Jason and Kurt, the fireman, spoke on the deck. He went to check on his grandson's 4-H pigs at the barn on this property. He said Shirley would always take care of feeding them, and they were still eating when he saw them. He noticed that the rest of her chores hadn't been completed and thought someone or something must have interrupted her. Then he went back to the house and noticed her jersey gloves were gone. Brad Kaufman, a friend of Jason's and a farm chemical supplier, came by the house. Jason told Brad that he had started the tractor to circulate the chemicals in the sprayer and that he had greased the sprayer, also known as the zert. But Bill said he noticed that the zerts were not greased and the tractor wasn't running. He said other than that one firearm, nothing else was missing. Shirley's purse was still there. Their prescription medication was still there. And the other guns in the home were still there, too. Jason started pointing things out to Bill. He showed him the gun safe in the basement and the live shell in the door. There was also an empty box of ammunition. Bill said he became upset with the investigation and that he felt like evidence had been left at the house. Defense attorney Christine Branstad cross-examined Bill. She began to point out inconsistencies in Bill's timeline.
It wasn't just that you said that Shirley was stiff. You said that Shirley was in rigor mortis and that you know what rigor mortis is. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That was a few days after Shirley's death when you were unhappy about the investigation. Is that correct?
Right. I also had been told by Jason that he thought his mother had been dead for 2 hours.
Well, and that's what you thought initially also, wasn't it?
No, I really didn't. I didn't know. I'm not an expert on that.
Well,
I still couldn't understand how I could pick her head up without lifting her body.
Iowa DCI agent Mark Ludwig responded to the house shortly after the sheriff's office. He was tasked as the lead investigator overseeing the case. Bill said he talked to Agent Ludwig at the house after Shirley had been found dead. Agent Ludwig told him that Bill could have done this after they got back from getting coffee. Bill said he was told that it was either him or Jason. Ed Bull then asked additional questions on redirect.
June 19th, 2015, did you have any reason to believe Jason Carter was in any way responsible for your wife's death?
No.
Were you at that time looking to see if Jason's emotions were real and sincere?
I was.
And did they appear to you to be?
They appeared to be. Although there were times when he was, when you couldn't understand him, he didn't have any tears.
Then Branstad got up again for the recross.
Over the course of the last few years, you're no longer talking with your son Billy, are you?
I am. He doesn't want to talk to me.
And there have been months upon months that you haven't talked with Jana.
Objection, relevance.
Sustained.
I also haven't talked to my grandkids.
You need to wait until another question's asked, please.
Brandon Smith knew both Jason and Bill. He worked as a farm implement dealer at the local John Deere dealership. He said that in the fall of 2014, he recalled riding along with Jason in a combine and asking if he would ever farm with his father. Jason's answer caught him off guard.
I asked why he didn't farm together with his dad, and his response was, I can't because my mom is a bitch.
Did it surprise you when he said that?
A little, yes.
Why?
I have known Shirley about as long as Bill, and it was just, she didn't strike me as that person. I guess I just didn't realize that that was how he felt, I guess. Kind of took me back a little.
Jason's sister, Jana, was also called as a witness. 2 days after the murder, Jana said she went to the house to clean. Jason and his wife, Shelley, met her there in the afternoon. That's when Jason made a statement she said she will never forget, when he started talking about bullet holes and damage in the kitchen. She said he stood by where you would walk into the house and said, whoever shot Mom was standing right here like this when they shot her. Jana then testified about going to the funeral home to see Shirley's body. She said Jason laid over their mother's body and said, Mom, this wasn't supposed to happen. At the time of his mother's death, Jason was having an affair with a woman named Tara Kozlerich. At the civil trial, Tara testified that they had sex several times in a week and that he would contact her on a prepaid phone. At the criminal trial, Tara was never directly asked about the affair, and it was never explicitly explained. But what the jury did learn was about how frequently they texted each other on that second phone.
On the morning of June 19th, how frequently did the two of you text?
It would have been back and forth quite a bit all morning.
Do you have any idea how many text messages you sent?
No, not something I usually keep track of.
At some point, did the conversation end?
Yes.
Now, had that occurred in the past?
Yeah.
And what would happen on your end that would cause you to no longer be texting Jason Carter?
Either an interruption from phone call, other messages, being around family where I couldn't, basically a situation where I wasn't able to message him.
And did Mr. Carter ever explain to you the same thing on his end?
Yes.
In the past, had there always been given an explanation either before or after why it was that the text messaging came to an end?
Yes.
Did that happen that morning?
No.
Did Mr. Carter provide you any notice that the communications were just going to end?
No.
Was your conversation that morning, without telling us any of the details, such that you expected it was at a logical stopping point?
No.
On cross-examination, Tara said she didn't perceive Jason to be troubled while texting with him that morning.
Now, you said that you shared personal information. Did Jason Carter always speak positively about his mother?
Yes.
From what you could see, he appeared to love his mother?
Yes.
Did you ever have any sense that he was angry or mad at his mother?
No.
In fact, would you say he was close to his parents?
Yes.
I think at one point you said the worst thing he ever said about his mother is he couldn't eat grilled cheese anymore because she made a lot of that when he grew up.
Yes.
Branstad also questioned her about Jason's finances.
Did you work in a financial capacity?
Yes.
So when Jason Carter talked to you about dealing with his line of credit, did he appear to be under any great stress?
At first, yes.
And then did he appear to resolve that?
Yes.
Were you one of the people who explained to Jason that it's not that unusual for a credit line to be delayed?
Yes.
The prosecution played clips from police interviews Jason gave, including on June 19th and June 22nd, 2015, and clips from his testimony at his civil trial on November 29th, 2016. They also played a video recording from inside a patrol vehicle while a deputy drove Jason and his wife to the sheriff's office on the day of Shirley's death. Investigators don't believe Jason and his wife knew that they were being recorded. Bull had a deputy organize the clips from the interviews by topics in order to try to show inconsistencies with Jason's statements. One topic area was the amount of time Jason said it took for him to get from his vehicle in the driveway to his parents' house. At one point, he said he was in his truck for a bit and that he may have even sent out a text message. But at another point, he said he was only in his truck for maybe a minute, that he went right from the truck to the house. Another topic area was whether or not Jason saw blood when he first saw his mom. In one interview, he said he didn't see any, and in another, he describes seeing deep maroon blood next to her. In yet another video, Jason tells investigators that he never touched his father's gun case and that he never even knew that it existed. But when prosecutors called Anna Young, a criminalist with the Iowa DCI, to the stand, she said that out of 55 fingerprints that were found on the case, 31 of those belonged to Jason. Another Iowa DCI criminalist, Mike Helverson, testified about the crime scene team's investigation and admitted that they had left some evidence, like the gun safe, behind unintentionally. Branstad only had one question for Agent Helverson on cross. She asked him, what did the collection of evidence ultimately show? Helverson said there's no forensic evidence, no DNA, no fingerprints, no ballistic evidence that he's aware of that said Jason Carter was responsible or not responsible for this death. Dr. Jonathan Thompson is a forensic pathologist in the state's medical examiner's office.
Does the report contain a description of the injuries to Shirley Carter?
Yes, it does.
And what are those injuries?
Mrs. Carter sustained two gunshot wound injuries of the chest. One entered on the front of the chest and then exited out of the top left chest area. The second gunshot wound entered on the right side of the chest and then exited out of the left side of the chest.
The doctor who performed the autopsy on Shirley Carter left the state, so Dr. Thompson read the autopsy report on her behalf.
After it passed through the sternum, there was the bullet passed through the heart and the sac that surrounds the heart. That's called the pericardial sac. This is in quotes. Dr. Gooden describes it as, quote, almost completely shredding and destroying the heart and pericardial sac, period, end of quotes. That description of completely shredding is significant because it suggests that the type of weapon used to kill Mrs. Carter was a rifle round from a rifle that was traveling at a high velocity.
He said the cause of death was multiple gunshot wounds, and the manner of death was homicide. According to Dr. Thompson, the autopsy report does not make any reference to the time of death. He said there's nothing in the report that would allow him to make a determination as to when Shirley died. Once the state rested their case, the jury was sent home for the day. The defense argued for more than an hour in front of the judge, alleging multiple Brady violations. Brady violations refer to the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Brady v. Maryland, which states that prosecutors must make all exculpatory evidence available to defendants in criminal cases. The lead defense attorney, Christine Branstad, argued that exculpatory evidence was not turned over by the state to her team. The evidence she was referring to was in the form of emails from Agent Mark Ludwig. She said the state had only just provided them during the trial and that she believed they showed bias, unreasonable delay, prejudice, lack of investigation, and collusion between law enforcement and plaintiffs in the civil suit. One email written by Agent Ludwig said that he had intended to arrest Jason during the civil trial or after the verdict and then immediately release him. Another email showed Agent Ludwig asking a state trooper to keep him updated during the civil trial, even though he was under sequester pending his testimony as a witness in the civil trial. Branstad called for the first-degree murder charges to be dismissed. The prosecution said there was no attempt to delay handing over evidence. Ed Bull said that requests for emails came very late from the defense, and they were provided as soon as the IT department could give them the voluminous amount. The judge said he would review the defense's motion to dismiss, but the trial would move forward. He later denied that motion. Then it was the defense's turn to present their case. They called Dr. Cyril Wecht, a forensic pathologist, as their expert witness.
Can you give us a few examples of some of the more notable cases you've been involved in?
Well, I've been involved in some official capacity, one way or another, attorneys, families, governmental agencies, with the John F. Kennedy assassination, the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King, Gene Harris, Sonny Von Bulow, Waco Branch Davidian fire in Fort Worth, Sandra Levy, O.J. Simpson, JonBenet Ramsey, Phil Spector, and some others.
For this case, Dr. Wecht reviewed investigative reports, first responder notes, recorded conversations, the medical examiner's report and autopsy, Shirley's medical records, and weather reports.
You were asked to attempt to determine approximate time of death for Shirley Carter, is that correct?
Yes.
Were you able to do that to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
What is your opinion?
In my opinion, Mrs. Carter had died about 2 hours, possibly somewhat more, possibly a little bit less, but no less than 1 hour. More, most likely, my opinion I would express would be around 2 hours, recognizing some variation up or down, so to speak, from a temporal standpoint.
And that was 2 hours prior to?
To the time that Mrs. Carter was found to be dead by her son, Mr. Jason Carter, and then with Mr. William Carter, her husband, and then Ms. Goff, the EMT person.
He said he based his opinion on background investigative information, rigor mortis, settling of blood, and Elgor mortis, the body temperature. Jason Carter had arrived around 11:04 a.m. Bill Carter arrived around 11:17, and paramedics arrived around 11:30. The defense also called Bart Howard, a private investigator, to the stand to testify about all the possible routes that Jason could have taken on the morning of the murder. He testified that he recorded the times of three drives from Cargill and Eddyville, where Jason was seen on surveillance video at 9:57 a.m., to the farm in Pleasantville, where Jason went to drop off his semi, and then to the Carter home. On each drive, he drove different speeds and accounted for the time it would take to switch out his semi-truck for his pickup truck. The fastest time was 54 minutes and 6 seconds. But on cross-examination, Ed Bull pointed out that there would still be 7 minutes of unaccounted time. Another key part of the defense's strategy was the claim that authorities did not do an adequate job of investigating Shirley Carter's death. They also presented out-of-court statements to show alleged third-party culpability or an alternative suspect. This is sometimes known as the Soddy defense, an acronym for Some Other Dude Did It. In order to overcome a hearsay objection by the state related to these statements, the judge read a stipulation to the jury telling them that in order to show that the state did not do an adequate job of investigating Shirley's death, the defense would be offering into evidence statements that were made by witnesses to law enforcement during the investigation. The judge cautioned that they should not consider these witness statements to be true, but that they may consider them only for the purpose of determining whether they were properly considered and investigated. The Iowa DCI conducted interviews after Shirley's death, but were not required to release those files until the criminal phase, which is why they weren't admitted into evidence at the civil trial. One of those interviews with DCI in the months after Shirley's death was one I told you about earlier, with Robert Joseph Sedlock. Sedlock, also known as Joe, was an inmate in Marion County, and he claimed two brothers named John and Joel Followill shot Shirley during a botched robbery. The following is an excerpt of that interview with Joe Sedlock, conducted by Agent Mark Ludwig and Iowa State Patrol Trooper John Thorpe in September 2015.
So regarding the homicide, what specifically do you know?
Oh, really? It wasn't a homicide, because I just what I heard, you know, on the street.
What do you hear on the street?
I think I got a guy that admitted to it.
Who's that?
The last. Or admitted that his brother did it.
How did, who did you talk to? Who did you get this information from?
I got it from Joel.
Joel.
Yeah.
And what did Joel tell you?
So they told me that his brother got spooked and shot this woman. Shot her twice, he said. And then it was getting all whacked out on heroin and pills. He was going to run his mouth or something. He was going to slip up.
So how did Matt obtain these kind of games? Do you know he was there?
He was there, yeah. It was those three.
The three of them were together?
Yeah, it's those three. That,
Joel, John, and Matt are together.
Yeah. And they do a lot of them. This is the first one they've done. I don't know if the woman walked in on him or what. I don't think he wasn't planning to go in there and kill her, you know. It's like she surprised him or something. And that's just what I heard, you know.
So how'd they pick this residence? Or why around this house?
I don't know. I know this. The Matt's the one that goes around and he scouts out these places. He's always got some harebrained idea why he thinks something somewhere or something. You know, I don't know exactly why, but it's usually guns or electronics. That's what he's after.
Because they're easy to get rid of, or what?
Yeah, I mean, he trades them for their dope, their pills, okay, or heroin.
The defense also called Agent Mark Ludwig, the lead investigator in the case, to the stand as their witness as well. Christine Branstad asked him about a woman who happened to have a name that sounded similar to Shirley Carter, named Sherry Carter, who was connected to the three suspects and who receives fentanyl patches and opioid painkillers. That woman's home apparently had been burglarized multiple times. Agent Ludwig said that John Folliwell told him that he has never been to the Carter home and that he believes that to be true.
Agent Ludwig.
Yes, ma'am.
Many, many people implicate Joe Sedlock, John Folliwell, and Joe Folliwell, correct?
Their names come up by multiple individuals. I'm not going to define many, 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 fourth many, but their names are brought up and I feel that we looked at Joel and John Folliwell, Matt Kamrick, and the evidence.
Your Honor.
I think the witness has answered the question. Ask another question, please.
At least a dozen of those people say that it was a burglary gone wrong. Correct?
I'm not sure how many people, but yeah. Burglary gone wrong was something that we knew by noon on the day of the homicide was going around the small community.
Do you have any reports that state that?
I believe it's in my report, yes. There's multiple interviews that were conducted.
Can you direct me to what report indicates that?
I think the neighborhood canvas section would make it very clear that that the rumors going around right away in Marion County.
I'm going to ask you specifically, I'm going to ask you not to keep generalizing. Can you name any report, one single report, from June 19th, 2015, that says there's a rumor that it was a burglary gone bad?
Law enforcement spoke with neighbors who said they saw a white truck in the neighborhood. Agent Ludwig said he believes that that was an unmarked law enforcement vehicle. There were also reports of an individual who appeared to be out of place in the area, but investigators determined that it wasn't connected to the case. Branstad continued asking questions, trying to highlight her claim that they didn't conduct a full investigation.
Is there something I can hand you that would help you come up with where and when you say on June 15th anyone said it was a burglary gone bad?
I'm confident there's interviews conducted in my report that indicate that.
Can you give any names or types or any description to those reports?
Not off my head, no.
Is it possible there is no such report?
It's possible, but highly unlikely.
Branstad also pointed out that investigators did not collect anyone's clothes on the day of the murder to test for gunshot residue. On cross-examination, Ed Bull took the opportunity to go over Agent Ludwig's background, including the fact that he's been in law enforcement since 1997. Agent Ludwig told the court that more than 200 witnesses were interviewed in the case. He said when Joe Sedlock came to light and gave his story while in jail, he was asking for a deal from prosecutors to help get custody of his kids.
Sir, has there been anyone during the investigation of the death of Shirley Carter that provided information that was consistent with what you found at the crime scene?
Yes.
Who was that person?
Jason Carter.
Sir, what information did Jason Carter provide that's consistent with the crime scene?
Jason Carter knew that, Dad, look, your house has been attempted or tried to be robbed. Jason Carter knew that, Dad, go downstairs and see if any of your rifles went off. Jason Carter knew that it was a rifle that shot that refrigerator. Jason Carter knew that it was Dad's rifle used to kill Mom, and furthermore, that that rifle has been removed from the crime scene, amongst others.
After 3 weeks of testimony, it was time for closing arguments. The prosecution gave theirs first.
Jason Carter, on June 19, 2015, is faced with one of the single most emotional, challenging moments in time, finding his mother. But he doesn't have any of the natural emotions that common sense would tell us that you'd have. He's not fearful. He doesn't freeze, flight, or flee. And he doesn't try to provide her any basic medical care. Why?
He said the crime scene was staged, that it's common sense. Nothing was taken except what was used to commit the offense. He said Jason knew that his parents' bedroom had been ransacked, and that's because he's the one who did it.
So we have all this pressure, and something happens. There's an altercation, and Shirley Carter dies as a result. There's only two people in this world who know what happened on June 19, 2015, and one of them is dead, and the other one's sitting behind me. Based on the evidence, and in support of that evidence, the state of Iowa requests that you find Jason Carter guilty of murder in the first degree.
Christine Branstad gave the closing arguments on behalf of the defense.
This was a case built against Jason Carter instead of a case trying to solve a crime and look at all the clues. And the terms evidence-based investigation. Well, we know the state's own criminalist said, I'm not aware of any forensic evidence. So now, what are we left with? And the state has based this entire case on the statements that Jason Carter did make and the ones they say Jason Carter made.
She asked the jury, given the lack of an investigation, can you really be sure?
At the end of this case, there are so many holes in this investigation. There's so much that isn't even explored. And in reality, the forensic evidence not only says that there's reasonable doubt, the forensic evidence says Jason Carter couldn't possibly be guilty. Shirley Carter died long before that, probably while he was at Cargill on video. I ask you to return a verdict of not guilty.
The judge allowed the jurors to take their notes into the jury room to deliberate. They were given two verdict forms. Verdict Form 1, not guilty. Verdict Form 2, guilty. They deliberated for 2 hours.
Form of verdict number 1, we the jury find Jason Carter not guilty. Is that your verdict, ladies and gentlemen?
Yes, it is.
Jason sat in his seat crying as he appeared to be processing what he had just heard. He hugged his wife, Shelley, and then his attorney comforted him. He then stood and turned to the cameras. I just want to go home and see my kids, he said. It's been a long time coming. I've had to endure so much. Prosecutor Ed Bull spoke to Law and Crime Network host Bob Bianchi after the verdict. He said this was his third homicide case he has prosecuted in 9 years.
We recognized from the very beginning that this would be a difficult case to present with the evidence that we had. But at the end of the day, we believed that we had a good faith belief that conviction was likely. And so we went ahead with the prosecution. But you know, as soon as you're sitting there and you present the evidence, we thought we did a good job. We clearly didn't convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And the chips fell where they did. And you have to respect, we respect the jury's verdict when they come back in our favor. We have to respect the jury's opinion and their verdict when they come back not guilty. It's the way our system is designed.
He said when the jury came back into the room, half a dozen of them were crying. He was asked if there's another suspect in the case. Bull said he wouldn't have brought the case if he didn't believe that Jason Carter was responsible, but law enforcement is still looking at leads. Defense attorneys Christine Branstad and Allison Canny spoke to Law and Crime's Jesse Weber.
I think we feel nothing but relief at this point. It's been a long road for all of us.
And Allison, I saw you there. Jason Carter put his shoulder right on you. I mean, what was that feeling like, getting that verdict back? Was it a surprise? I mean, what were you feeling at that moment?
It wasn't a surprise. It was the right outcome, but it was definitely emotional. I was sitting next to Jason intentionally because I'm the person that's been on the end of those phone calls with him at night. And it was just a huge emotional relief and evidence of hard work paying off.
They said they've all made guesses as to who could have shot Shirley Carter, but they're not ready to name one person. They said Jason and his father don't currently have a relationship and that the family has been torn apart. As for what's next for Jason, they said his wife is teaching and he's farming and spending time with his kids, trying to find a new normal, they said. After Jason's acquittal, he and his defense team appealed the civil judgment. But in June 2019, a Marion County judge said that Jason Carter is still civilly responsible for the murder and must still pay $10 million. Bill Carter told local media that the new ruling means very little because he doesn't expect Jason to ever pay him a dime. He said he still believes Jason was fueled by greed and killed Shirley. Jason and his father still farm next door to each other. And that's all for today's episode. I'd love to know your thoughts on this case. Do you think Jason Carter is guilty? Or do you agree with the jury in the criminal case that there is too much reasonable doubt? And what are your thoughts on the fact that Jason was found civilly responsible for the murder, but criminally was acquitted? Do you think that says something about the way our justice system works? Let me know by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, by joining our conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Today's episode was written and produced by Jennifer Tintner from Law and Crime. You can find her on Twitter at Jennifer Tintner. And that's all I got for today. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.